We start, though, with Pentagon Solutions, as we do every Wednesday. The trillion-dollar omnibus spending bill for the rest of this fiscal year should pass both houses of Congress by the end of this week. For the first time in a long time, we have an appropriated defense bill. One of the people looking at it is Gordon Adams, professor of international relations at American University and distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center, former associate director for national security and international affairs at the Office of Management and Budget. Gordon, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program this afternoon. Before we get into some of the nuts and bolts of this, what does it say that we're throwing the party that we're throwing about the fact that we have an appropriated spending bill?
Well, I think this is so much better from the Defense Department's perspective than what they might have expected had sequester happened, and it was due to happen sometime around now because the continuing resolution was about to go over the side. You know, from my point of view, they ought to be breaking out the champagne in the five-sided building because, you know, if you go to the headlines, the department has been asking for the last year for time and flexibility and predictable budgets. And guess what they got? Time, flexibility, and predictable budgets. You know, the replacing the sequester means they have a set level of funding. They know what it is. It's basically flat. Asterisk, we got to talk about the overseas contingency operations or war budget because that gives them a huge kitty here. But they got flexibility because it's not now a sort of a blunt instrument across all the accounts one by one. It's the ability to plan and move funds around, and they got a lot of reprogramming authority, about $9 billion, include intelligence, about $11 billion. You know, they ought to be just having a wonderful party over in the five-sided building because now they know for the next 2 years what the level's going to be. It's not the sequester level. It's higher. They've got the flexibility to move the money around and plan. Even though you got to keep in mind that this is flat, they aren't even getting inflation. It's a little bit down below the level of inflation, and it's going to be similar next year. And I predict in the out years it's not going to grow, but at least they know what it is. So they've got, you know, the bottom sort of essentials of what they needed to do defense planning. So, I don't want to hear any more whining from the Pentagon. They got what they wanted.
All right. It's a shame I never know where you stand, Gordon. you might want to come out of your shell a little bit, my friend. Now, you mentioned the headlines, and I want to throw some of these headlines at you and just get your sense of what they might mean and what they might what we might expect to see. I see things like this one from Defense News. Omnibus bill funds combat rescue helicopter. Inside Defense has lawmakers take axe to Army's GCV program. So we're already learning about some of the specific things that the branches either wanted or didn't want anymore. Do you see any trends developing there that we should think about or pay attention to?
Well, I think what you see in general in this bill, whether on the procurement side, the hardware that the services either want or don't want to buy or to keep, you generally see appropriators doing what appropriators do best, which is put back the things that they want to have and take out the things they don't want to have at the edges of procurement. But there are things that sort of annoy the Department of Defense. For example, the Department of Defense has been trying to close down a Block 30 program of the unmanned aerial vehicles that they don't want anymore and isn't as cost-effective as flying a U-2. The Congress put it back in. The Army would like to get rid of the M1 tank production base for a couple of years because they don't need to use it. The appropriators on the Hill put the money back in. So you got a series of things like that. The Navy wanted to retire these Ticonderoga-class cruisers. The appropriator said, nope, not only do you have to keep them, you got to give us regular information about how you're upgrading them, and we're going to give you more than $2 billion to work with these puppies. You know, on the procurement side, the Congress basically did what they normally do and have been doing for the last couple of years. When the department tries to kill something, the appropriators seem to want to put it back into the budget. So from the industry's point of view and from the some of these programs are going to hang around. From the Department of Defense's point of view, the Congress has basically done what they always do, which is say no.
So there's not anything new there as far as what we can expect the Congress to do trend-wise.
No, there's not really any surprises here.
If they're not changing it now, we don't expect to see anything different in 15, 16, and
out. They boosted a lot of money for Virginia-class submarines. Welcome to the Virginia delegation and the Armed Services Committees. You know, they're doing the things that they would normally do. And because they have slightly higher budgets than the sequester would have given them, and they got a little more room to play with and plan, the Congress has appropriators have found room that they can find to put in the things on the procurement side that you want to see. But these are not really policy-driven decisions. These are really interest-driven decisions on the part of the appropriators.
You mentioned the Armed Services Committee, and there is some news about the House Armed Services Committee that I want to get your take on later on in our conversation, Gordon.
Right.
But the back to the headlines here. Lockheed F-35 comes out ahead in spending bills, defense accord. That's from Business Week. It appears that the programs like the LCS, Littoral Combat Ship, and the F-35 that have been under some attack from people off the Hill especially, seem to still be in pretty good shape on the Hill.
They're in pretty good shape, but basically what you got was pretty full funding for what the department requested for some of these large programs. And that's fairly typical. You know, the Congress has made it clear, and the department made it clear, that if they went to the sequester level, one of the sacrificial lambs would probably be four of the 29 F-35s that they wanted to put into the budget for fiscal 14. Because sequester didn't happen, we're at the 29 that were originally requested. Things like that are now staying in the budget. So you could say Lockheed Marietta dodged the bullet. You know, that's nothing huge has been plussed up here above what the administration wanted to have.
The other thing that I took away from this as being fairly remarkable is something that you mentioned early on, Gordon, and that is the Overseas Contingency Operation budget, the OCO budget, $85 billion. It's 7.3% over what the administration asked for. And I'm not sure what to take away from that other than I was very surprised to see that.
Well, I wasn't surprised to see it at all. For the past really 10 or 12 years, but especially for the last 3 or 4 years, both the Congress and the administration have tended to use the Overseas Contingency Operations funding as a kind of a kitty, as a place to go to cushion the effects of things like sequester and falling budgets. The thing about the Overseas Contingency Operations account is it does not count against the budget caps. Right, it's not measured in the budget caps of the Budget Control Act at all. So if you want to find a finagle to have some extra money be available, especially in the operational accounts, you park it over in the OCO, and the appropriators did something real interesting here. They did a couple of interesting things. Scrubbing the bill myself, I have seen not only did they increase funding above the administration's request for the war budget, if you go through the operational accounts for the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps in the base budget, the non-OCO budget, you find that they moved more than $8 billion out of the base budget and into the OCO account. So they moved things that were eating up funds, if you will, in the base budget, making room, therefore, for things like the hardware programs that we're talking about earlier. And they parked all of that money over in the OCO and then just grew the OCO account by, you know, another $5 or $6 billion in order to adequately do the things that they wanted to do. And what's critical about that is in the readiness area, because most of the OCO account is operations and maintenance money. It means it covers readiness and base support and depot maintenance and fuel acquisition and all the things it costs to operate and steam and fly and drive the military, both in operations and in training and educating at home and the like. Well, you got whole huge fungibility here. What it means is, you know, money that's appropriated is appropriated at the level of something like Army operations and maintenance or Navy operations and maintenance. Inside that category, the department has huge freedom to allocate and reallocate resources for things like readiness and operational support. So what this really means is, if you will, the Congress has stepped outside the constraints of the Budget Control Act and made it possible for the department to solve every conceivable readiness or even pseudo-readiness problem they thought that they had by having this great big $85 billion kitty off to the side that doesn't count, but is even bigger than the administration requested for the operational activities of the services.
I seem to recall a conversation that you and I had, and I believe it would have been in the 6 to 9 months ago period, Gordon, where we talked about the possibility that the OCO budget eventually would go away because the point of it was to fund the wars that we are now in the process of removing ourselves from. And I believe your stance at the time was, don't expect to see that happen anytime soon. And so it appears that this is bearing out your prediction. When we come back, Gordon, I want to talk to you about, as I mentioned, some news from the Armed Services Committees today, in particular the House Armed Services Committee. Gordon Adams of American University and the Stimson Center, my guest on Pentagon Solutions today. We'll continue in just a moment. Pentagon Solutions today, as we do every Wednesday to start off the 4 o'clock hour, today with Gordon Adams of American University and the Stimson Center. And Gordon, we talked about the news breaking this afternoon that the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Congressman Buck McKeon of California, will not seek re-election. He will leave the House of Representatives after a long career, both as the representative from California and also as leader of the House Armed Services Committee. Any expected changes? The name we keep hearing this afternoon is Congressman Mac Thornberry, who is his number two right now on that committee. Probably doesn't mean a whole lot as far as changing of the guard, does it, Gordon?
No, I don't think it means an awful lot. What's interesting about Buck McKeon is that he spent probably, I'd guess, 75% of his time over the last 2 years trying to stop sequester. Really, since August of 2011, the lead item on every agenda that Buck McKeon brought to the table was stop sequester on defense, stop sequester on defense, stop sequester on defense. And what was fascinating to watch over that sort of roughly 2.5 year period was that by and large he failed in his mission, especially through 2012 when sequester happened. Despite all of his jumping up and down and trying to keep sequester from hitting defense, sequester hit defense. So as chair, he found himself swamped by the broader tide of disputes in the Republican Party and the general opposition to increased federal spending and the desire to get the budget down, especially among the House Republicans. I suspect some of that was part of the reason he decided he'd had enough, because that gets pretty frustrating after a while. Thornberry is a very respected guy. He is, in some respects, more of a detailed guy on defense than Buck McKeon was. Very smart on the details, very well educated, and more interestingly of a moderate. He's not in the image of the Tea Party in the Republican Party. So I think you're going to see somebody who takes the helm, if the Republicans keep the majority, and I think they're likely to, who is a master of the detail, who knows the issue very well, who's pretty much respected even on a bipartisan basis, taking over the chair of that committee, maybe being a little less shrill than McKeon was on the sort of protecting and defense from the broader budget issues, but, a very workable chair.
I want to go back to the headlines that we talked about earlier, and one that I saw today on National Journal is Air Force Undersecretary warns of risks in budget cuts. And that's at the same time that we're seeing this budget deal coming out and we're learning about things, for example, as we talked about the OCO actually being more than we expected, final funding still about 4% under what the administration asked for. And I wonder if we can expect, in your view, to continue to hear people like Eric Fanning and the Joint Chiefs and the other leaders of the military branches, people from OSD, talking about the dangers of budget cuts, even if they stay in the 4 or 5% range over the next couple of years, or if that's something that, because they got just a few cuts in exchange for the time, flexibility, and predictability that they've been asking for, as you alluded to earlier, that those calls for ends to the budget cuts might dissipate.
I think for probably time eternal, most players in the Defense Department have felt that the best way to sell a defense budget was to say, we're going to be in deep trouble if any of the cuts that you're talking about happen. The trouble that the department ran into, and I think the reason that something like what Mr. Fanning had to say is not going to resonate much, is that last year in the period of sequester, the Defense Department shrilly warned, frankly, of what would be the consequences of a sequester on the Department of Defense. And you know what? It didn't happen. The reality is that they came through the year with the sequester. They managed it handily. They did the things they had to do. It didn't make a long-term dent in the readiness of American military forces. It didn't wipe out procurement programs right and left. It didn't eliminate a million jobs in the economy. It didn't close factory doors. All the stuff that was being warned of, frankly, by the department and the industry last year, most of it didn't happen. And the people who ended up paying a little bit of a price were the six-day furloughed civil service employees in the Department of Defense. That kind of, if you will, wore out the welcome mat for the argument that, you know, disaster was staring us in the face as defense budgets go down. Keep in mind that we are, even at the $572 billion level, and oh, by the way, that's what it is. Let's not forget that OCO account. The real spending in defense is over $570 billion. We're still spending at unprecedentedly high levels. We're around the 2006-2007 level of spending. That's, you know, wonderful compared to where we were from the department's perspective. They have a lot of money. They got issues they got to manage on pay and benefits. They got issues they got to manage in terms of the size of the overhead, the back office, and the building. There are real internal pressures. Nobody isn't saying there is. But the reality is that the department has stable funding. It knows where it is. It managed a sequester that took a significant $37 billion chunk out of what they planned to do, and they managed that. More power to them. They had the flexibility. They had the OCO. They had the operational money to do that. And now they've got greater flexibility, more time, and more stability. So it just seems to me that, you know, crying wolf again about, you know, what's going to happen if the budget goes down just doesn't bear any relationship either to historical reality or where we stand today.
But you're not discounting the fact that we might still continue to see those arguments, Gordon, it sounds like.
Oh, I think we'll see them in perpetuity, because it's always seen for some reason as the best way to sell a defense budget is to say, if you change one iota of what we're proposing, our national security will collapse in a heap.
Gordon Adams of American University and the Stimson Center, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for your time today, my friend.
Thanks very much.